But
this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In comparison to much of the rest of the country, Charlotte was spared a lot of the volatility of the 1960s and 70s. However, there is one little-known incident that, at the time, grabbed headlines and made history, and it all started in a backyard shed. In 1968, two young men from East Mecklenburg High School began publishing a magazine. Actually, five did. Its liberal bent raised more than a few eyebrows and eventually became the first case in America where the free press and the First Amendment clashed with zoning laws. And here to tell the story are two of the five original writers and editors of a publication called The Inquisition, Linwood Sawyer and Russell Schwartz. Welcome, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning.
Good to see you. First of all, is it The Inquisition or is it just Inquisition? Just
whichever you prefer.
Okay. I'm about to give you the Inquisition, so get ready. They're here in our Spirit Square studio, obviously, along with Suzanne Sink, an English instructor and the author of an essay on this piece of Charlotte history, which is part of a research paper which she published on the impact of the Southern underground press movement of the late 60s. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You've missed the best part of the discussion. We've been having it before the show started. We'll try to catch you up as we go along here. There are actually five of you responsible for this subversive publication. Who were the other three?
Lee Douglas.
Tom Wilkinson.
And Hanson Dunbar. But there was a huge peripheral, we never called ourselves a staff. We called ourselves a Calabria, because it was indeed a collaboration. But there were a huge number of other people, such as Richard Nagel and Paul Jones especially, and the artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tom Brown, Becky Paget, and Donna Robertson.
And let's be clear here, you weren't even around with
it. No. No, sir.
Your knowledge of this comes strictly from research.
From research.
And I'm going to ask you, what made you interested? How did you find this, and what made you interested in it?
Well, I've always been interested in historically, musically, culturally, that 1964 to 75, like Kennedy assassination to Nixon resignation. And once I finished my master's degree in English, I began to think, well, what would I want to study in a PhD program? What would I want to really focus on? And so I started thinking, okay, well, I want to look at the literature of this time period, but I quickly kind of realized that if you look at the establishment press, you don't really get a sense of the counterculture of the time. You have to look to the periodical press, to things that were published in the moment, of the moment. And so that's when I started thinking about periodical press, underground press, and I'm interested in Southern literature, so I wanted to look at Southern underground press. And there's a lot that's been done with Berkeley, Chicago, New York, Village Voice, and Berkeley Barb, and San Francisco Oracle, but not much from the Southern underground. And there was, most people are surprised that there even was a Southern underground.
It was way underground.
Well, actually, due to the military bases and people being drafted and brought from outside areas into these military bases, there is quite a lively Southern underground press tradition.
Okay.
So I found the Underground Press Syndicate, which was a network of underground media sources that shared information similar to the Associated Press. They had a list of all their different publications that were part of it, part of the Underground Press Syndicate. And so there was a listing on the website for Inquisition, Charlotte, North Carolina.
How unusual, from all these different publications that you looked at, was it for a group of high school students running the Underground Press in terms of the Underground Press in the South? Was that atypical or typical?
High school students and college students comprise a large majority of the underground press during this time period, because they were so significantly impacted by the issues of the time. We were talking earlier about Vietnam and the draft, and that young people having this vested interest in what was happening around them and speaking out about it.
It was 1968. The two of you, at least, were juniors in high school, East Mecklenburg High. Were the other members of your coterie also juniors?
Yes.
Yeah. Which is the class of 69, right?
Yeah, what
did you call about the
line? We're the class of 69.
Do it again. I talked over it.
Sorry.
Do it again.
I'm sorry. Acid grass, mescaline, we're the class of 69, which we indeed got the cheerleaders to stand up on the cafeteria table and chant during one of our lunches.
Well, you are a radical. you were at the time self-described progressive thinkers. How do you explain that in the heart of the traditional South, that you, five of you, turned out to be these progressive thinkers? You were at the top of your class, I know that.
We liked words, and we wanted people to use precise words, and we resented being lied to, and there was a lot of lying going on, especially in regards to Suzanne said about the war. I mean, the Vietnam War to us at the time, and to me now even, was a complete load of garbage. I mean, I'm sorry that people died, but we were being sold a bill of goods. Kids were being killed for no particularly good reason, and we had the under-ambassador come speak to a high school convocation. And he foolishly, you know, there was a question and answer session, and he foolishly selected me. And I raised my hand and I said, Mr. Ambassador, isn't it true that we're in Vietnam to protect the deep water port at Haiphong and the manganese deposits? And his response was, next question. And we suspected them all at this point. We knew they were lying. And, you know, we were right about Nixon, too.
Yes.
The only president removed from office, yeah. You know.
There was also the issue of there was a tremendous, it was the beginning of the psychedelic era of music, none of which was being played on the Charlotte radios, with the exception of Fred Cornu on Underground, 1 hour a week on Saturday nights. And
what station was that?
WYFM.
YFM, which is 104.7, but that station has long since gone into the...
Because I was looking through a past issue of your... Well, they're all past issues, aren't they?
Right.
Of Inquisition, and there's an ad in here for WIST, which is an old AM radio
station.
Right.
No,
mm-hmm.
Also no longer exists. Were they playing the kind of music that you're talking about? Or
they would occasionally play stuff, but you have to remember, put it in context, they wouldn't play Strawberry Fields Forever on the radio because it was a drug song.
Here's the ad. WIST, 1240 kilohertz. A.M. A sleeping giant awakes Charlotte's only hard rock sound. Whoa. Suzanne, the students that wrote in this magazine, the students wrote in the magazine, rather, that one of the... I'm trying to get this right here. These students wrote in the magazine that theirs was one of Charlotte's few, if only concrete, examples of what liberal high school students are thinking. And you go on to say in this magazine, in the South, this liberalism was perceived as a threat to the innocence of the youth and the overall safety of the community.
Mm-hmm.
As much as things change, they stay the same.
Yeah.
why was there a fear of liberal young people?
Well, there's a great editorial that was published in Charlotte, Charlotte Observer. It was a mother who was saying, you know, that she was afraid of the Inquisition because she had a 14-year-old son who sort of soaked up these ideas about, basically, the perception was drugs, danger, violence, sort of, you know, rebelling against the traditions and the traditionally held views, both, you know, religious and moral. And so there was just this fear that they were going to, through their ideas and disseminating these ideas, that they were going to give credit to and influence others to have these sort of ideas. And I think it was just a time where new emerging, you know, modernism was sort of clashing with traditionally held views. And so, you know, on one side you had these young people saying, let's move forward, let's have these new ideas and new ways of thinking about things, and that was dangerous.
Plus, the whole culture was changing. The youth movement was in. Hair was getting longer. Clothes were changing. In Volume 2, Issue 3, which cost 25 cents, by the way, there's an article.
Big poor, bucks in this stuff.
That's right. Poor Richard Rapps. Stole that from Ben Franklin, did you?
Right. He was a reporter at the Charlotte Observer.
Really?
Yes.
And he wrote for you?
Under the name of Poor Richard.
Really? So he could keep his job.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh.
How did you get adults to be a part of this?
They got a lot of adults. They sought them out. One of the more interesting adults that they wrangled into their paper was T.J. Reddy, who is a local author, poet, and artist, but who's also later one of the Charlotte Three, one of the three young men who had been wrongfully accused of burning down a ranch and was imprisoned for about on and off for a decade.
Wow.
And they published some of his poetry prior to him becoming a nationally published poet. They sought them out. They went out and sought out.
Well, in this edition, Poor Richard raps about being treated badly at a restaurant And he says, it's finally happened. You can finally be turned away from a public place because of the length of your hair, your mode of dress, or maybe just downright unconventional appearance. It happened Saturday night. A few friends and I decided to go by the Shelf and Kettle Pancake House on Independence Boulevard. That's long gone. For something to eat. Everyone was stoned. He's a reporter for The Observer. As we approached the entrance, a boy with longer than average hair who had just come out of the restaurant told us, they won't seat you. What? We replied. Try it and see, he said, but you probably won't have much luck. This brought us uptight, of course. But hell, we couldn't split without trying. We ambled in and waited for the waitress to seat us. As dictated by the sign at the door, the manager flashed up from nowhere, started mumbling something. Nobody could understand him, so he finally found the guts to look us in the eye and say, a little louder this time, we can't serve you. And it goes on from there. So things were changing, and young people were coming up against a lot of different obstacles, it seems. Huh?
Yeah, well, and we weren't taking any of it. We had it. Like I said, we were catalyzed by being lied to. Constantly, we were called into the high school principal's office and told that we're going to get our we don't like you drug doing hippies and you're going to cut your hair. And this is from the principal who has a 500 capsule bottle of Librium on his desk
from dealing with
and
us.
And we said we're not cutting our hair, and you can talk to our attorney. And we handed him George Daly's card.
Now, I looked at a photograph of the five of
one,
you.
One footnote to that. God bless my father, who had been on my case nonstop to get me to cut my hair. But as soon as the principal, somebody outside the family, told me to cut my hair, he said, grow it down to your bleep.
Now, there's a photograph that appeared, I think, in the Charlotte Observer.
Yeah, those are all Observer.
Of four of the five of you.
They don't look radical.
You don't look radical. You're all wearing V-neck sweaters, villager sweaters probably, and button-down shirts.
Hair's a little long.
Hair's a little long.
Touches the ears.
It looks like everything in my high school yearbook. Yeah. Of course, I'm a contemporary of yours. And we didn't think of ourselves as being radical or even having long hair.
Well, my hair then was about the length that yours is now.
Right.
And they were all over us. You're dirty. You look terrible.
It came over your collar. It was too long.
Right. Now, according to Zan Sink's paper here, the five of you advocated, and I quote, and I want people to listen to this very carefully because this is what you advocated, you young rebels, you, maximum personal freedom, peace, and racial equality.
Yeah, what a terrible thing to advocate. You know? I'm so embarrassed.
Why did that sound so controversial? Or was that wasn't really what was controversial, was it?
Well, in those days, it was a little
bit. The racial equality.
It was 1968. Equality. Well, I guess you're
still
right.
Still segregated.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It only happened in 63, so just 5 years.
So the Civil Rights Act was 64, and... I mean, you could make a fairly strong case that there's still a fair amount of racism going on right. In the country, and that's been 40 years ago.
Why were you so far ahead of the curve, do you think?
Not stupid
yes.
would be my first
And
pick.
How many of your fellow classmen not involved in the paper felt the way you did, thought the way you did?
10%?
Really?
Something like that.
With
what was
maybe it? Another 10% sympathetic.
Yeah.
So you're in the minority, essentially.
Yeah. One of the things I found through the research was that... you know, it's easy to look back at some of the other papers and out of San Francisco and say this was part of like a fad. Like we want to look a certain way, we want to dress a certain way. But they arrived at this independently through study.
We have to stop here. We can take a break. We'll come back with more in just a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Garage Door Guru, providing local, comprehensive garage door service for over 11 years, including repairs and door installations. Now offering Herman Garage Doors. Details and appointments, 704-661-9070. And also McCall Center for Visual Art, welcoming the public to a gallery reception, Friday, January 27th from 6 to 9 p.m. Featuring Converge, an exhibition that explores art, identity, and culture. Details at McCallCenter.org. On this program tomorrow, church integration and Martin Luther King Jr.'s hope. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once wrote, "Worship at its best is a social experience with people of all levels." His vision for more integrated churches has not truly come to fruition, but several area religious leaders hope to change that. We'll hear from them tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Civil Rights in America, what's been achieved since Martin Luther King's era, and the most pressing issues of today.
That conversation and much more in 2 hours of the Diane Rehm Show. It's coming up right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded radio, 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source.
We're just going to have to eliminate the breaks in this show because the show continues off the air. Stop talking off the air. Don't waste all the A material on the B audience here. We're talking about Inquisition, which was an underground newspaper that started in a backyard shed in 1968 by five members of the class of 69 at East Mecklenburg High School. And it made the waves and it made history. And Linwood Sawyer and Russell Schwartz are both with us. They are two of the original five editor-writers. Suzanne Sink is an English instructor and the author of a research paper on the impact of the Southern Underground Press. She brought this to our attention, and she has done a lot of research into this publication in particular and the Underground Press in broad ways. What was your original mission at this publication? Because this was an outgrowth, was it not, of the literary magazine?
Yeah. Partially. We had several submissions that were not accepted for the high school literary magazine. And we thought they should be published, and we went, well, if you guys won't publish them, we will.
And we also wanted to stir things up, so we actively solicited people with completely opposite viewpoints to our own.
Really?
Just so that we could antagonize a greater range of people.
Yeah, the first issue prints a pro-Christianity essay by a student who was bothered by what he perceived to be a loss of religious tradition. And they published that, which would be somewhat antithetical to what people would assume they would publish, but they wanted to.
So you were going after a full open exchange of ideas. And as you said, Russell, off the air, you were taught how to think.
Yeah, well,
and you were using that information.
In those days, school was pretty good, and we were taught how to reason, and we weren't shy about using it.
Well, we haven't really talked about the controversy. We'll get to that in a second here. But in the course of that controversy, obviously, this went to the school board of the time. And I was actually surprised to read the reaction of one school board member out of your paper. Betsy Kelly was her name. And Suzanne, you quote her as saying, "I'm willing to take a chance on this endeavor. We put a lot of stock in teaching our youth how to think. And when they do, we're shocked. These boys aren't stating positions. They're raising constitutional questions. They're using a lot of satire and attacking the hypocrisy of our generation." That's pretty forward thinking. Mm-hmm. Was she backed up by other members of the school board?
There were two school board members that voted. Basically, Principal Pittman, D.K. Pittman, had banned sales of the magazine on campus. And the editors appealed the decision to the school board to be allowed to sell the magazine on campus. And Pittman's decision was upheld, but the vote was 5-2. And two board members did support their right to be able to sell. And they applauded what they were doing, even if they disagreed with the content. And I think that's really what's at the heart of it is that, you know, even if you don't like what people are saying, we have to defend their right to say it.
What also shocks me about that comment is that she says, "We put a lot of stock in teaching our youth how to think." Today, they would say, probably we put a lot of stock in teaching our youth how to pass the end of grade exam.
Or tell them what to think as opposed to how.
Well, thinkers are dangerous people. How did you regard yourselves? I mean, how are you, 17, 16, 17 years old?
17, 18.
And you're going up against the establishment in Charlotte. You're going up against the police. We haven't talked about Freedom Park, but we will. You're going up against the principal of the high school. I remember being I was a goody two-shoes. So I was a friend of our principal, Mr. Secord. He was a good guy, and we didn't have this kind of stuff going on when I went to school. But I remember that if you went to the principal's office for any reason, even if it was just to be, could you empty the trash? You were like, oh God, I'm going to the principal's office. You were going up against this guy.
Was a good person, you know, but he just was a different generation.
But what was it like inside you, because you were making waves and people were paying attention. You were in the Charlotte Observer.
We were having
TV stations were covering you.
We were having a great time, and and I mean, I hate to say this, we were kids, and we're living at home, and we don't have jobs and positions that we have to protect. And you know, there's certain things that you can't say as an adult because I need to remain employed. I'm attached to sleeping indoors and eating regularly, and you can't do that if you have a position in the world where you have to appear in public and do this.
Well, your parents
did. We had the luxury of not having that problem.
But your parents did have that problem. So this is a very conservative town today. It was probably a lot more conservative in 1968. What was their reaction to that? I mean, I know your father backed you up on your hair length, but what was their reaction when they first saw the publication? And then when they saw the reaction to the public.
Well, each set of parents had a different reaction. Russell's mom thought, this is weird, but she let us use her shed. Hans's mom was incredibly supportive because she was very progressive herself. My parents thought, oh, Lord, what is he into now? And I think that was sort of what Lee Douglas's parents.
Yeah, they weren't quite. I think those pairs of parents didn't quite get it, but the weirdest things were that the grown-ups, who theoretically are sophisticated intelligences, could not spot satire. In the issues, there's a thing called A Note to the Would-Be Sorcerer, in which Lee writes this big, long, complicated article about how to conjure up the devil. Well, none of us believe that you can conjure up the devil. It was completely a joke. And we had, remember, I think it was on the school board, accused us of being in league with the devil.
Yeah, well, Julia Malden found that.
Rolling our eyes and going, and these people are running the show?
That was majorly problematic.
Don't run for Senate in Delaware. Okay? It'll come back to haunt you.
Yeah.
Or governor, whatever she was running
for. It's funny you mentioned the parents, because a lot of the contributors that I spoke to said they published under anonymous names or pseudonyms, not because they were afraid of what the school officials would do, but they were afraid of what, they were anonymous because they were afraid of what their parents would say.
Well, and also it was because only three or four of us were writing the article, and to see the same byline time after time was a little bit boring. So.
Did you anticipate that there would be controversy, or did it surprise you that there was controversy?
We didn't care. We were, I think, pleased when it did. But I think we just wrote what we wanted, freedom of speech, say what you want, and that people reacted to it. We got attention. And, I mean, a lot of this, I mean, being a performer or a musician or anything, you're looking for attention from other people. And we got attention doing this, which certainly didn't bother us.
And we also got free tickets to rock concerts.
And review copies of records.
Yes.
Back at those are the days, weren't they?
Right.
Was there any particular position that you took or any particular article that appeared that got you into the pages of the Charlotte Observer or got the attention of the Observer? Or was it the association of Poor Richard with the Observer that got you into the Observer?
Well, what happened was...
It started with Kay Reimler at the News, the evening edition, Charlotte News.
Okay.
She, on March 1st, 1969, she published a feature. At this point, they had already published six issues of The Inquisition, and then Kay Reimler featured them in The Inquisition, and then that was on a Saturday, and then on Monday they got hauled into the principal's office and said no. Well,
so you what had happened I'm sorry, was she, in a journalistic no-no, I think it was Russell said, we sell the Inquisitions at the school, but this is off the record. And she wrote, Russell said we sell Inquisitions in the school, but this is off the record. And then next.
So he said it before he said this is off the record so she could print it, right?
Is that,
I think
that
what,
how it works?
No, I think what,
was a big deal.
What really got the hackles up was Lee Douglas said, so far they've been pretty cool about letting us have it, and if they try to do anything about it, he'll have five full-time radicals on his hands. And I think that left the principal no choice but to act. You know, he was made to look like he turned a blind eye.
So he called you into the office. You had been selling this under his nose. They took no note on campus at East Mech.
Right.
And he called you into the office.
Called everybody who was in possession of a copy to the cafeteria.
Everybody who had a copy.
Yes, right. Everybody who had a copy
had to come to the
cafeteria. And
half the student population turned up.
Yeah, and And then he dismissed all who had possession of it, but kept those who were selling it and the editors, and said, you can't sell it anymore, and you have to cut your hair, or you'll be suspended. And then that's what led to the school board appeal. The school board held up the Pittman's decision, at which point they brought George Daly, who is an ACLU lawyer, into the case to represent them, and he filed two suits against the city and against the zoning board.
Now, this is getting serious.
Yes.
When you get a lawyer involved, this is getting serious. Mm-hmm. This, I would think, required some acquiescence of some sort from your parental units as Saturday Night Live has said.
No?
The most exciting thing that happened was when all of this hoo-ha started was I was at home, Mom was there, and I believe his name, and I may have this wrong, was T.C. Birmingham of the City Zoning Department, came into the house and told me that we had to, in his words, cease and desist publishing the newspaper.
Why?
Because we were in an R9 district, a residential area, and you can't run a business out of a residential area. And I went, great, and he left, and I went, wait a minute, we're publishing a newspaper. This is Trump's this. And then we got Daly involved. Yeah. We said, this is our freedom of speech here.
To back up just a little bit, they had tried to sell copies at Freedom Park, and they were told you can't sell without a distributor's license.
Right.
And so they went to the tax collector's office and obtained a tax license.
Let's back up a little more.
Yeah.
At the time, and many people may be shocked to hear this, Freedom Park was kind of a hippie hangout. Right?
Yeah, there was Hippie Hill in Freedom Park.
So you kind of just walked through Freedom Park with your publication and sold it for a quarter, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Who stopped you from selling?
Away, we would
police
sell
officer.
Again.
A police officer, yeah. That's, well, that at the Nixon rally, you said that was the only publication that turned a profit. They showed up at a Nixon presidential campaign rally and sold it to people in the parking lot who thought, oh, these upstanding young men who once they opened it, tossed it on the ground. They picked them back up and resold them and turned a profit. A police officer in Freedom Park said you can't sell printed material without a peddler's distributor's license.
And was that true at the time?
That was true.
Okay.
And so then they went to the tax collector's office, and it was Fred Griffith who was in the tax collector's office.
Yep.
And he said, well, I will not issue a license unless you get approval from the police department, which is illegal. You can't force any sort of publication to get approval from the police department. But they did go to the police anyway. They did go to the police and...
Well, they wanted to look at the content, didn't they?
Right.
Yes.
And the police said, well, basically, it's not pornographic. So, okay, it's a little weird, but we give permission. So they went back to the tax collector's office, got their license, and at that point they were actually a business that paid taxes. And they continued to print. But after the school board meeting, William Poe, who was the chairman of the school board committee, according to George Daly, basically felt like he needed to further assert his authority over this challenge, particularly because professors from UNC Charlotte had come down and in support of them. And so he really, Daly felt like he really needed to further the point. Not enough that we're going to ban it at the school, but we are going to shut it down completely. At which point the zoning board showed up at Russell's house and said, you must cease publication altogether.
And Mr. Poe said that he was shocked at the support of UNC Charlotte professors of this publication. Did not get freedom of speech at all. Freedom of the press. Evidently.
No.
But how can a high school or a school board have any jurisdiction whatsoever over a publication not being published on the campus, being published out of a shed in your mom's backyard? How could they have any jurisdiction over that?
I think Poe just had a lot of influence and was able to sort of find this
way. So were they doing end runs around the law consciously, or were they just trying to exert their influence because this needed to be stopped, damn it?
No way to know.
Trying to flex their ego.
Yeah. According to to be fair to the other side, they say that they got a phone call, that the tax collector's office got a phone call saying, we'd like, how can we go about having a publication like the Inquisition? And they said, well, you can't because you can't publish it out of a residential zone. And the caller, the so-called caller, said, well, how come the Inquisition gets to do it? At which point they were forced to act. But it's funny that it was only like 4 days later after the school board meeting that they showed up to the zoning board showed up. So time-wise, it really looks as though after the school board, how dare they come up here and sort of confront us in this way? Let's find a way to stop them.
So you have a lawyer, an ACLU lawyer at your disposal, and boy, did you luck out with the judge. You got Sam Ervin III as your judge. Yep. He's the son of the late Senator Sam Ervin of the Watergate hearings that many people, not all, but many people fell in love with during the Watergate hearings.
And he was also the editor of the Davidson College newspaper.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
He decided in your favor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was that like to go up in front of, to go to court, go up in front of the judge, Sam Ervin or not?
Well, it was a little nerve-wracking to do. We were excited because we were getting our day in court, kind of.
Had you suspended publication or were you still writing?
We were working on the next issue.
The judge had issued a temporary restraining order against the city to allow for them to publish.
So you were writing about the trial in the publication, I take it?
Well, we were writing about it, yeah.
Okay,
and
right.
We were working on the next issue, and when we went in there, I mean, I've said for years that the last time for me that Inquisition was really fun was doing the court case. When we won the court case, we had kind of demonstrated we were right all along. And that felt really good, and even now still feels pretty good to say it. It's been pointed out to me that if the Charlotte Observer wanted to put their presses in your neighborhood, would you like it? I wonder about that.
Now, tell me if this is true, because people complain. One of the reasons you couldn't have this press, and we're going to talk about what the press was a little later on, you couldn't have this press in your neighborhood was because of the noise it made. And is it true that one of you brought in a lawnmower to demonstrate the difference in the noise?
Yeah, Tom got my mom's lawnmower, and we took it to court, and we were going to fire it up. We had the printing press with us, and we were going to compare the sounds, and the judge said, "That's all right. I know what a lawnmower sounds like."
You've made your point, son. Yeah.
The printing press basically went, whoom,
whoom. I mean, your printer in your office makes about the same amount of noise.
Put your headphones on for just a second. We'll take a call from Spencer in Charlotte. Spencer, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Good.
These guys are more effective than they ever thought they might be. Me and a bunch of my friends used to go to Freedom Park and buy these papers and take them back to Lancaster High School and sell them. And it went so far as we started our own underground newspaper called the Lancaster Subterranean Digest.
That's great.
And even though we got busted with that and we didn't get the first issue out, I'm sure that there are people all over three or four counties that were coming to Freedom Park and buying those things and taking them back to their own high schools and causing trouble, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't really trouble. It was trouble for the kids.
And I got to tell you, no matter what, whether you agree or disagree with the positions taken by the various contributors to Inquisition, it's extremely well written. It's really smart.
Yeah.
I don't think it could be done today, do you?
As a composition teacher, I can only hope.
All right. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of our three guests and talk more about what exactly, how this all came together, how you do this as a high school student in just a couple of seconds. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Opera Carolina, presenting Puccini's Madama Butterfly, January 21st, 26th, and 29th at the Belk Theater. Face your opera at 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.org. Well, here on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, Diane and her guests discuss the most pressing civil rights issues in America today. A look at what has been achieved and new challenges ahead. That's on the Diane Rehm Show, coming up at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. This is a holiday rebroadcast, so we won't be able to take your phone calls this morning. But stay tuned. Conversation continues just ahead.
This is Ira Glass here to tell you that you can now hear This American Life every Friday night at 7 p.m. on WFAE. Each week, of course, we bring you stories that you will not hear anywhere else, stories that unfold like little movies for radio. We work hard to find amazing stories that just turn and turn and turn. And then after our program, stay tuned for The Moth right after us at 8 o'clock. So to review, you can still hear This American Life Saturday afternoon at 3. Now we're also on Friday night at 7 on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Inquisition, a paper that was produced by 5 high school students at East Mecklenburg High School in 1968 that raised the ire and the shackles and everything else you can think of in a negative vein of a lot of people in the power structure in Charlotte on the school board at the high school principal level, went to court to continue publication, etc. Linwood Sawyer and Russell Schwartz are 2 of the 5 gentlemen who are responsible for starting that paper and all the stink that it caused. And Suzanne Sink is an English instructor and author of a research paper that really does a great job of delving into the Southern underground press, but particularly with regard to this publication, Inquisition. I want to point out that you can read the last issue of the Inquisition, published in 1969, at our website. You can also see a photograph of the 3 people we have as guests today, and I think we have one way back when on there as well. And you can go to our website at your leisure and read that. The 60s were a time of civil rights protests. Schools were desegregating, which also led to protests and violence. The youth movement began to change the nation's social mores. Drugs became more widespread among young people. One of the pieces in the literary magazine that was not able to be published at the time, I believe, was very sexual in nature.
Suggestive.
And suggestive.
Right. Well, by today's standards, it was very mild and tame.
But that was a very different time. And there were, of course, the protests.
And it was written by a female student, which I think heightens that.
And there were the protests over Vietnam. So how did your publication handle each of those issues? What did you take points of view? Were there just guest columnists? How did you handle that?
A little bit of both. We had our opinions, certainly. In the day, we were pro-psychedelics, anti-war.
So pro-psychedelics means drugs?
Yes.
Okay. Did you do them?
I'm not telling you.
Okay,
I'm
just checking.
Of course, I didn't miss the 60s.
Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Communist Party?
Although they were accused of it in Rose's department
store. I did not miss the 60s.
I interrupted you. Go ahead.
And we like Suzanne pointed out, we wanted to give people an outlet who didn't have an outlet. The literary magazine was a fairly cliquish affair, actually. Mm-hmm. And we said, well, we'll publish anything. You give us the stuff, we'll publish it. We'll correct your spelling and stuff.
Even if we disagree with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't care if we disagreed with it. We just wanted people to have an outlet. I mean, the Jeffersonian concept that the country would be better with newspapers than government is a good idea. I mean, democracy works when people participate in it. And that you got to get their words out there.
And the stakes were higher because, as Suzanne mentioned earlier in the program, particularly the guys, they were facing the draft. And there was this whole deal about not trusting anybody over 30 at the time because of being lied to. Kids today don't have that in their lives, do they?
I don't think they have that unifying principle.
Is that better or worse? Were these guys better for having that? Or worse for having that? And today, in comparison, are the kids better today because they have an extended youth?
No. Is it better? Yeah, it's better that we don't have the war. It's better that we don't have the draft. But what that did was give people a vested interest in being involved. You needed to be involved because it involved you directly. Now that the students don't have that sort of Damocles hanging over their head, the need to be involved, the vested interest to be involved isn't there. I do think we're better off if we are critically thinking about what's happening around us and if we're engaged in the process and if we're knowledgeable about it.
As you read through the essays that appear in these publications that they did over the course of a year, you're a composition teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Grade them.
A+ content and ideas, execution, organization, mechanics, certainly weren't the most important part of
we're not
part
the
of
New
the
Yorker.
Process. Yeah. So, but I don't think that's what makes it great. You know, mm-hmm. I think you had people expressing themselves through a variety of ways. Poetry, there's a David Childers poem about the assassination of the American Nazi
David
Party.
David Childers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, he wrote a poem called Werewolf about the assassination of the American Nazi Party president. There were essays. Russell wrote one about, mistreatment of Native Americans, which was certainly ahead of its time. They wrote essays about nonviolence. And so I think certainly they were expressing themselves through whatever mode of writing was most comfortable for them.
Greg Schaible I'm sorry, go ahead. So,
and we also need to emphasize how important the graphics were to illustrate, emphasize, and underpin.
Very good artwork in here, mm-hmm. I think. And Greg Schaible, is that how you say his name? He couldn't hold because he had to go teach class, but he wanted to pass along the fact that his first published illustration was in Inquisition.
Yep.
Cool.
Yep.
Yeah. That's great.
Because I remember that whole psychedelic art form that, mm-hmm. that came out in that time period, and then you can see that graced the covers of album jackets and were in all these underground papers, was a whole new style of art. Kind of, I guess psychedelic is the only way to describe it. I don't know how people came up with it. I guess they came up with it under the influence.
It certainly didn't hurt.
I talked to some of the artists, and they were inspired in some part by the album covers that they saw. Mm-hmm. But it was a very lush style. Mm-hmm. It was very much full and round and swirling.
And we have to remember that it was all done by hand, not on a computer.
Right.
The conflict with your publication lasted about 18 months. How, and aside from the article that started it all, I guess, in the Charlotte Observer, Charlotte News, how was it handled in the mainstream press of the day, including television? But television was in its television news, local television news, was in its infancy.
As far as I know, I haven't run across any television news mention.
Well, I do know that WBTV.
WBT editorial.
I thought that was on the radio, though.
No, WBTV ran an editorial.
Yeah, that was
on
BTV.
On television.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and they were in support of your magazine.
Uh-huh.
Well, and the newspapers were in support because, I mean, I have to say this, we were in the same business. I mean, it's being a little grandiose, but they believe in the freedom of the press, and so did we, you know.
You had a circulation at the height of all this of as many as 2,000 copies per issue. How often did you publish?
Bi-monthly. Yeah,
intermittently would be the best way to describe it. It was theoretically a monthly, and it never was.
Well, because you were at the top of your class, and to be at the top of your class, you have to study. You have to, and you are also self-described readers. You were reading well above high school level, at an adult level. When do you have time to live and publish this magazine and go to school and do your homework? And
they lived in the shed.
Seriously, how do
you? Well, we spent a lot of time working on the paper. I mean, we get out of school and go work on the paper. It was our passion. It's what we wanted to do.
How did you know how to work on the paper? What did that mean?
We learned how to do paste ups, and I mean, this is back in the days, no computers, remember?
Right.
It's like you type it and you tape a little piece of paper to the sheet, and then you take that and have it photographed and put onto a master, which ran on the Multilith 80, the giant printing press that we had that Linwood acquired from his church. And we learned how to do it by doing it.
Uh-huh.
You know, we figured, well, people can do this. We can do this.
I have a photocopy of this. I hesitate to say Xerox. That's a brand name, but you know what I'm talking about. I have of this publication. And I'm just curious. It looks like it was typed on an IBM Selectric.
It was. It was on a Smith Corona, most of it.
Okay. Yeah. And I was going to ask you what a... what's it called? A multilith? What did you call it?
AM multilith. Yes. Dressograph multilith.
Is that like a mimeograph or a...
It's a very small offset press.
Right. So it wasn't a stencil machine.
No, it was an offset press that was used. The church used it to print their weekly bulletins because it was a big church. They had thousands of parishioners.
Mm-hmm. So this is a we're censoring ourselves here. I just want you to know they're censoring each other here. All right, enough. We will move on.
One thing I would like to add, though, you know, at our heart, we were all capitalist. And the Junior Chamber of Commerce at East Mecklenburg that year was making bird feeders, I think, which they were selling at cost, and they barely made a profit. Mm-hmm. We were always a profitable capitalist organization throughout our history.
But I want to point out here, now this is not like writing a blog today, which gets potentially billions of eyeballs. This is doing a newspaper on this tiny little printing press where you have to not only write it and edit it, but you have to cut it up, type it out, cut it up, paste it up, photograph it, run it off, staple it, fold it, distribute it.
Right.
How did you do this? I'm serious. It wasn't a staff of like a newspaper has.
You'll love this. We would print the individual sheets that make up the magazine, and we'd put them in stacks on the floor of my mother's living room, and we'd get in a row, and we'd hand them down, and the guy at the end had this saddle stapler. You'd hit it and put the staples in it and fold them in half and put them in a stack and do it again. I mean, it was this rudimentary. It was like vacation Bible school stuff.
And then would you go out and sell it, or did you have a sales staff?
We would sell them.
Sell them to anybody who would give us a quarter.
But it was you out there handing them out.
Yeah.
Why? Why did you do this?
I hate to say this, but it was immense fun.
Well, no, as we said at the time, why not?
Why not? And it was fun. I mean, I hate to say this, but we were kids.
Yeah.
We were full of ourselves, I mean, in all honesty, and we were having a great time.
As I understand this, you got one of the last known interviews.
Ron Parson.
With Jimi Hendrix.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
Who was coming through town. Where was he playing? The Coliseum?
Coliseum. Yep.
Coliseum. Mm-hmm. And you talked to him in his room?
Ron and Parson. Gary Rice did, and we haven't been able to track down Gary Rice.
Well, where was that? I read it yesterday, but I can't remember
the
name.
Ramada
No. The Ramada was where they thought they were staying, but then they ended up going over to
the red carpet. Or
red carpet,
yeah, that's
on
right, the
Independence.
Red
Boy, times have changed, haven't they?
Yes,
And they picked up the phone because they were hoping to meet Jimi Hendrix at the concert's after party. Is that right?
Right.
So they picked up the phone to talk about the after party and talked to Jimi Hendrix. There was no after party. He had no entourage.
Nope. Mm-mm. It was just him staying in the hotel room.
Now, there's in that article about Jimi Hendrix, because it's not just about the interview, it was about the show, and I'm trying to find it here. They talk about the atmosphere at the Coliseum, because the police evidently were either under instruction to keep control, either by the Hendrix people or by the city people, and it was pretty... You know, stay in your seat, no cameras,
locked
no recorders.
Down, yes. Uh-huh.
Why were they so concerned about recording equipment?
That may very well have been from Hendrix management.
Yeah.
I mean,
they had to open cases and show that they examined your camera, make sure it wasn't actually an audio recorder.
Still goes on in a lot of places.
Yeah. Well, that was pretty forward thinking back then.
And so Hendrix's show was quite good.
It was phenomenal, yeah.
And so when they talked to him, they went to his room and talked to him. Was there? I read it yesterday, and it seemed to be rather innocuous. They didn't. He didn't really share a lot of information.
Well, no. You know, again, I got a contract job to write a screenplay based on the life of Hendrix, based on the biography. Excuse me, While I Kiss the Sky, and it was very difficult because reading the biography, he actually was a very quiet, shy, almost passive person.
Really,
and this wild, crazy person that appeared on stage was an act, you know. It was very difficult to find a conflicting narrative through line.
Huh.
And this is sort of the side of Hendrix that Rice and Ron Parsons, who recently passed away, by the way, saw.
So did he? I would think he really didn't want the passive side to be seen. That would kind of destroy the whole image, wouldn't it?
Ron and Gary's reaction finally did come in. He says, he's a really nice guy.
Yeah.
I mean, that was their impression, was that he's a really nice guy, kind of like another hippie. You could play the hell out of a guitar.
Once again, you can read the last issue of The Inquisition on our website, but also that essay about Jimi Hendrix is on the website as well. Very quickly, put your headphones on. We'll take a quick call here before we have to end this today. James in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have a quick anecdote. I was in class of 2002 in high school in Polk County, and this was, you know, nothing serious, but we felt that we were being overcharged for tomatoes at the time. So we printed a little leaflet and made the Free Tomato Friday, where basically we gave away, you know, nice thick slice of tomato. Came to school, gave them away, handed out a little leaflet, claiming that they were, you know, taking the 55 cents and investing in tomato farms and making money.
And what year was this?
I was class 2002. We were juniors. So it was probably about 2000.
So it continues.
Hopefully.
You've set a standard here that is hard to match, but it does continue. Thank you for your call, James. I'm curious, what happened to the five of you? What did you go on to do in life? That would be Linwood. Sawyer.
Yes, sorry. A writer. I've studied the mystic way with this silent Indian master named Mayor Baba first with his brother, now with another disciple for 40 years. I'm writing movies. I just had a film premiere in New York called Spy, the movie with Vinnie Pastore and Ben Curtis. Hey, the dude, you're getting Adele. And
really?
Yeah. great guy. Really, they both were a lot of fun to work with. And unfortunately, 20 minutes into the premiere, I got a phone call from my mother that my father was dying. Funeral was yesterday.
I'm so very sorry.
Hi there, Dad.
We have 15 seconds. Russell?
Well, I grew up, and now I'm designing disc golf courses for a living.
Disc golf courses?
Think frisbee golf, the best way to describe it.
And what about the other three, very quickly, very quickly?
Lee's in California, associated with Berkeley.
Okay.
Hanson lives in Charlotte, and Tom works on theater.
Yeah, Tom's a stagehand.
Okay. Well, you've had a great life so far. Keep going. Thanks to the two of you, Linwood Sawyer, Russell Schwartz, and to Suzanne Singh for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.